Our next case is 821-1345, the estate of Michael Conaran Jr. versus Michelle, if I pronounce this correctly, Knipe et al. As all parties are aware, this matter is being recorded. However, our rules prohibit any party or observers from making their own recordings, so please comply with that. Counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whatever counsel for the appellant is ready to proceed, just begin and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Curtis Ripley. I'm the attorney for the appellants, Vesper Properties, Greg Crane, Michelle Knipe, and the Tax Minimizers. And on issue today, or excuse me, on appeal today are two issues that arise out of the district court's denial of the defendant's motion to dismiss in the underlying case. The first issue is the district court's denial of the defendant's motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. And the second issue is the district court's granting of an injunction, which ordered the placing of certain funds in escrow while the case is pending. There were some other rulings in the district court's denial of the motion to dismiss, but it's those two issues that are appealable at this time. And as between those two issues, the motion to dismiss and the injunction, I'm going to be spending most of my time on the personal jurisdiction issue. The issues with respect to the injunction have largely been resolved by a subsequent agreement among the parties, and I'll address that momentarily. Before getting into some of those legal issues, I will very briefly recite the facts. This case arises out of an underlying real estate and other asset sale involving entirely Arizona residents. Michael Conaran, who is now deceased, was a long-time Arizona resident, and he decided to sell some of his assets to other residents in Arizona. And that is the Vesper Properties, one of the appellants in this case. That transaction took place a couple of years ago, and it happened entirely in Arizona. All of the parties were in Arizona at all times. All the
agree, counsel, that Mr. Ripley, that all of the property resides solely in Minnesota?
I don't think so, Your Honor. There are two assets at issue. One of them is the real estate in Minnesota, the farmland, and that's certainly in Minnesota. The other one is ownership of American Crystal Sugar beet stock. I don't know that ownership of stock can necessarily be said to reside in Minnesota. ACS is a company that's headquartered in Minnesota, but it does business in multiple states, and it's got stockholders in multiple states.
And just on that question, in the briefing it talked about, and I don't know how to pronounce the name, it began with G, but the person who actually farmed the sugar beets, I believe.
Goditis, I believe is how that's pronounced, Judge Smith.
Okay, but I didn't see, unless I missed it, where he is.
I didn't see
anyone talk about his location, so.
I believe Mr. Goditis is in Minnesota, and he's the one that, his connection to this, Judge Smith, is that he actually farms the, not the farmland that's at issue here, but he is the farmer responsible for the beet stock.
So with respect to that, is it ACS? I'm sorry, what's the name of the?
American Crystal Sugar.
Yeah, or ACS. Okay, American, right. So with respect to that property, that cooperative is based in Minnesota, and the farmer who farms the beet stock, the beets related to this stock at issue is in Minnesota.
That's correct. I believe Mr. Okay. Goditis is in Minnesota. His involvement has been pretty limited here. He simply farms the beets, and there's an agreement in place pursuant to which the profits from those shares go to the owner of the beet stock. ACS is headquartered in Minnesota, and I believe it's incorporated in Minnesota, but it also has offices in the Dakotas and Montana, I believe. Now, on that sort of related point, the other asset is this farmland, and that farmland is situated in Minnesota. But the party who farms that land pursuant to the lease with Vesper is actually a North Dakota entity. They're not a Minnesotan either. The transaction here at issue, like I said, took place entirely in Arizona. None of the parties came to Minnesota in connection with this. And so as we go through the five-factor due process analysis, there simply aren't connections to Minnesota out of which these claims arise that lead to minimum contacts. And the only Minnesota contacts that are alleged here are not those that give rise to the underlying claims, the purchase of these assets from Conoran in Arizona, but what I would characterize as after the fact transactions or interactions with non-parties to this case. Mr. Gudaitis in Minnesota is not a party to this case. Neither is ACS, nor is this North Dakota entity that farms the beets. Though after the transaction with Conoran was completed and after he was deceased, Vesper Properties had contact with those entities to make arrangements for a new lease and to simply notify ACS of the transfer of the stock.
Mr. Ripley, let's say for the sake of argument that no one was challenging jurisdiction and the deal went through, and then for whatever reason, your clients stopped paying on the note. Would the lawsuit brought by, I guess the estate, or if Mr. Conoran was still alive, would he be suing your clients for breach of the note in Minnesota or Arizona or both?
Well, I would assume he would assume it in Arizona. And in fact, the estate has sued in Arizona. There is right now a pending lawsuit with these same parties involving these same facts and these same allegations in Arizona right now. In terms of the note, I will say that the note called for the transfer of the property to Vesper Properties upon death. So I don't know that hypothetical would have arisen, but that lawsuit certainly should have been in Arizona if there was a dispute as to these parties under these transactions. And as I said, there is an Arizona lawsuit right now involving these very same claims and very same parties.
What is your best case? Because what happens here, I mean, I think that what's at issue is part of this is quiet title. Who should actually own? Let's stick with the real property. Let's put aside ACS for the time being. And so, it's one thing when there are cases where, a Minnesota seller of or lessor of airplanes like Dent Air or something goes out of state, advertises it, sells to someone out of state, an airplane, et cetera, or leases it. Okay, that transaction, the seller aggressively went out of state to a buyer and the purchase took place out of state, not Minnesota context. But here we have real property that stays here, is only here. The buyer files legal documents in order to, assure that their own protection of the property. How can that buyer not think that they might be hailed into a Minnesota court for Minnesota property where they take advantage of the filings, et cetera, and recordings that need to be made in order to protect their rights to that property?
I think the critical issue there, Judge Smith, is that both the buyer and seller were Arizonans. And so at no point, one of two things will happen in this case, depending on who wins. If my side wins, then an Arizona company, Vesper Properties, will own this Minnesota real estate. If the respondent wins, then another Arizona entity, the estate, will own that real estate. The property physically happens to be situated here, but the dispute is between two Arizona residents. And so I don't think the fact that the land happens to be situated here in a dispute entirely between out-of-state parties, not involving any Minnesotan or the rights of any Minnesotan, conveys personal jurisdiction on a transaction that occurred entirely out-of-state.
What's the case law? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I did want to know what case law involves, if any, real property in a state that you would point to as supporting your argument.
I'm not aware of any case law, Judge Smith, which holds that a dispute between two out-of-state parties involving land that happens to be situated here conveys personal jurisdiction on either one of them.
Is there any case law that deals with real property that we should be looking at all? I mean, that rejects it, that accepts it. You're saying there's nothing that accepts it. There's nothing that rejects it, I guess, either.
Correct, okay. Judge. That's my understanding. I certainly haven't seen a case that goes either way on that, and certainly not one that holds that every dispute between two out-of-state parties as to an asset that's got a Minnesota connection conveys personal jurisdiction on both of those. You did mention the real estate filings, and you know, I think one point on that that needs to be noted is that none of the defendants actually recorded those real estate documents. The recording actually took place by a third-party title company. I understand that those recordings are done for the purposes of preserving our rights and protecting our interest in the land, but I, to your point about not being aware of any case law, I'm not aware of any case that holds that the recording of real estate documents with a counter recorder by a third-party title company for an out-of-state purchaser subjects that purchaser to personal jurisdiction in that state in a transaction with an out-of-state seller. And that's, I think, really the key here. There could be a hypothetical situation in which the interests of some Minnesotan were involved, but that's just not the case here. One Arizona entity will own this real estate, either the respondent or the appellant, but it doesn't implicate the interest of any Minnesotan. And that really gets to this issue of conspiracy jurisdiction, which I want to address, because I think that was one of the things that the district court relied upon and really sidestepping the minimum contacts analysis for each of the defendants. The judge had a reference to there being allegations of a civil conspiracy in this case, and that appears to have been the basis for his holding that all of the defendants are subject to personal jurisdiction, even though he didn't analyze minimum contacts for each of them. We go through this in our brief, but I think the real key point with so-called conspiracy-based jurisdiction is there has to be some harm of the alleged conspiracy that is felt in Minnesota by a Minnesotan. And that just didn't happen here. Even if we accept the respondent's conspiracy allegations as true, that some conspiracy was hatched to deprive Conoran of these assets, that effect was felt entirely in Arizona. There's no Minnesota claimant here and no harm to any Minnesota resident. And in each of the other cases, both in Minnesota state court and in the federal courts that have dealt with the issue of conspiracy jurisdiction, there's been some harm and some connection to Minnesota. And that's lacking here. So we simply cannot use conspiracy-based jurisdiction as a way to get around the minimum contacts analysis that's required for each of the defendants. There are four defendants in this case. Vesper Properties, which actually purchased these assets from Conoran, Greg Crane, who's the principal officer of Vesper, Michelle Knipe, and then her company, the Tax Minimizers. Well, the district court's opinion on due process and minimum contacts doesn't even mention two or three of those four defendants. And we cite numerous cases holding that due process and minimum contacts is an analysis that has to be done on a defendant by defendant basis, and that each defendant is entitled to that analysis. That simply didn't happen here. We think there are enough facts to conclude that there aren't minimum contacts, but at the very least, a reversal and remand would be required so that there could be an actual due process inquiry for each of these four defendants. And again, I think one of the key takeaways here is that none of the conduct in which any of these defendants engaged had any harm or any impact that was felt in Minnesota by any Minnesotan. And the only Minnesota connections that have really been manufactured here are these after the fact interactions that one of the defendants, Vesper Properties, had with non-parties to the case in Minnesota. We're not aware of any case law that provides that transactions that happened after the alleged conspiracy with non-parties would give rise to personal jurisdiction.
What are you referring to specifically there? What action? I'm sorry, I might have missed.
Sure. The Minnesota connections in this case that the respondent alleges and that the district court found were Vesper Properties reaching out to ACS after the completion of the transaction, negotiating a new lease for the farmland with a North Dakota entity, and then recording these real estate documents after Mr. Conoran's death. That all took place years after, or a year after, the purchase of these assets from Conoran in Arizona. And it's the interactions with Conoran in Arizona that are the basis for these claims, not these so-called Minnesota connections that took place long after that.
So and, even though they would, the argument is, well, we're entitled actually to the value, the rent or the, is it dividends, whatever the payments are from ACS. You're saying even though those might be Minnesota, that those can't be considered at all because they're not the basis of the fraud claim, like sort of the damages that occur later?
No, that's not what the respondent's theory is. They're trying to reverse the transaction with Conoran that took place in Arizona to say that they get the property. This is not a suit between our client and the beet stock farmer or the landowner regarding rent. That would be a different situation where the minimum contacts analysis could be different. This case isn't about the rent or the a dispute with the farmer or with ACS or with the beet stock farmer, but about the underlying transaction in Arizona.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ripley. Mr. Hasbrook, you're next.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Initially, I think when we look at the district court's order, what I'd urge the court to focus on initially is kind of the stage we're at. And I think we have to take this step by step. The case was commenced in November of 2020, ended up after a change of counsel among the defendants that caused some delay, ended up before the district court in the summer of 2021. And at that point, no discovery has been accomplished whatsoever in the Minnesota case. So the matters came before the district court early on, and as both parties agree, based on the citations in the briefing, the jurisdictional issue was to be made the district courts to determine if there's a prima facie case of jurisdiction, and that's where we're at. And I think that is plainly made, because not only can we establish a prima facie case, but I think it's clear even at this early stage of the case that there is the gist, the core of this claim can be brought nowhere other than in Minnesota. And so what's the gist of the claim we're bringing? If we look at the complaint, the amended complaint, just to kind of put it in big picture terms, look at the designation of the case type. Well, it's to quiet title to property. This is a quiet title action at its core. And then there's some additional and ancillary claims brought in it. And defendant number one, and this is the part that, why I think we saw a fairly brief analysis from the district court. Defendant number one is Vesper Properties being sued to quiet title to this real property, and also determine and declare title to the American Crystal Sugar Company stock, which of course in this case is a Minnesota cooperative, and the particular stock at issue that's being farmed by this Mr. Gruditis is being farmed in Minnesota, as Mr. Ripley told you. So we've got Minnesota assets, the title and rightful ownership of which is being disputed. That has to be done in Minnesota. And of course,
let's leave aside the real estate for a moment, mm-hmm. but for just property that exists in the state, we're in personal jurisdiction land, right? Mm-hmm. You're not arguing that there's some in rem jurisdiction that establishes personal jurisdiction in the case, right?
It's both in this case. The quiet title portion would be in rem in nature.
And so then, when we look at the Schaefer case, the Supreme Court's decision in Schaefer, I think that might be cited by the parties, from 1977, the U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court. What does that tell us about? I mean, I did not understand in rem jurisdiction to satisfy the due process requirements for personal jurisdiction.
No, and we wouldn't contend it does.
Okay, but okay.
What we would contend is in following the Gilman decision that I cited in page 22 of our brief, it talks about the presence of the property. Let's take ourselves out of in rem, and maybe I misspoke, but there's an element of quiet title to this, but take ourselves out of that and put it into the personal jurisdiction world. And it talks about the presence of property in the state, if nothing else, bears on the existence of jurisdiction by providing a contact among the forum state, the defendant, and the litigation. And it goes on, when claims to property itself are the source of the underlying controversy between the plaintiff and the defendant, which we have here, it says it would be unusual for the state where the property is located not to have jurisdiction. In such cases, the defendant's claim to property located in the state would normally indicate that he expected to benefit from the state's protection of the interest and the state's strongest interest in assuring the marketability of property within its borders and a procedure for peacefully resolving disputes. That's a loose quote. But that's really, so we have this gigantic elephant-sized contact, which is the property, both the stock and, of course, the real property in Polk County. And then defendant number one, this Vesper Properties, is, of course, the owner of the property. And we go back to that court language from Gilman that I just read. And it talks about you, certainly if you own this property, you would expect to benefit from the laws of the state. That, of course, plays into the purposeful availment, category under personal jurisdiction law. And we have that here over and over. And that is all the filings. And we've laid them out in the brief, and they're all in the record and affidavits, the real estate filings.
What benefits? Are your clients receiving by being in Minnesota?
The defendants are claiming owner. Are you asking about the defendants or
yes.
about?
Yes, I'm trying to find out who's being. What is the benefit to anyone? Let's just go with that. Mm-hmm. From the land being in Minnesota. I know people have the privilege of paying taxes on right. that. So that's thank you. But what are the benefits to all these people?
The benefit would be through the various real estate. I think there's five or six specific real estate filings made, and there would have been taxes paid. The benefit would be I'm filing documents in Minnesota that make my asserted ownership effective as against the rest of the world, including Town and Country Credit Union, including others that might make a claim. So they're saying Minnesota law and Minnesota filings protect me and make this contract, which they assert was made in Arizona. And at this point, we don't know, and we haven't done discovery, make this contract that they assert was made in Arizona effective as against the rest of the world, including all of Minnesotans. So I think that's the biggest benefit Vesper is attempting to achieve. Or the biggest benefit Vesper is attempting to achieve. And I know there was a question of opposing counsel about, I read you Gilman, and I think there was a question to opposing counsel about are there cases that that say that when you're litigating title to property, you're not subject to jurisdiction in Minnesota when the property is in Minnesota? And I think the answer was, well, there's no, we're aware of no case that says it goes one way or the other. And, frankly, we didn't find any because I think this is a very clear issue. It's not one I would expect to be seeing pop up in appellate court decisions where we're litigating property and we're litigating title to Minnesota property and a party that is the owner of the property is saying, I can't be sued here. It's just not something we see in reported cases. It's not something I've seen before. So I think what we really focus on are the other defendants and specifically before yes.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so I think we have foundationally, we have a clear, undisputable jurisdiction against Vesper. And then we look at the other individual defendants and look at the nature of the claims. And are they subject? Well, I put in evidence, again, this is before discovery and we're at a prima facie stage. I put in my brief a clear description and it's Arizona filings attached to affidavits on pages 13 and 14 that discuss that what it appears to be on this prima facie stage that Vesper is really a nothing. It's a shell that acts at the whim of Greg Crane. It appears to have no business, no employees, no location other than of the attorney that formed it. And this was put forward to the district court in my brief. And the other party had an opportunity to put in additional affidavits, evidence, briefing, and there was no response to this. I mean, so I think at this point where we're looking at a prima facie case, we are dealing with what appears to be a shell corporation. And so that served as nothing other than the vehicle through which two people, Michelle Knipe and Greg Crane, could get title somehow to this Minnesota property and Minnesota real estate through wrongful means. And I think, you know, one thing the district court made clear, and again, prima facie stage, maybe things change as evidence develops. You know, the defendants will have their opportunity. But the district court made clear, it appears this property and this contract was taken through fraudulent or other wrongful means. I mean, the nature of the transaction is so egregious. What we're dealing with was an ailing Michael Connerin, who had been hospitalized and under conservatorship and appeared to be not long for this world, with property, Minnesota property, that had a value of approximately nearly $10 million, with debt against it of only about $1.2 million. So we have about, you know, I think if you do it up, close to $8.5 million of equity in this property. And he is alleged to have signed it, to have sold it to Vesper for $100,000 up front. And this is clear on the face of the documents. I know defendants say, well, even though the documents say that, we intended something else. Again, we're at a prima facie stage. Give me $100,000 now. And then in July of 2040, when this ailing Michael Connerin, who then is barely 60, reaches the age of 81, you give me the other $7.4 million, 0% interest. And in the meantime, and this is clear on the face of the transaction, we're challenging. In the meantime, Vesper gets all the income from the property. Okay, so that's the transaction that we are disputing here. Even before discovery, does that raise, you know, the district court found clearly, yes, it appears to be a wrongful transaction. Case isn't over yet. You know, discovery is going to be done and everyone's going to have their say. But on its face, it appears to be a wrongful transaction. And
may I ask you, counsel, yes. I think there's disagreement. What does the record tell us about, and what's your view of, whether this is a duplicate action in Minnesota for what's taking place in Arizona?
Thanks for the question, because that's just what I was about to address. There continues to be this statement, they've sued him in Arizona, the same parties, opposing counsel said, and the same claims. And that argument was made in the briefing to the district court. And I said, look, there's no such thing has happened. And so opposing counsel did put in a affidavit, this is all that's in the record about what's going on in Arizona. He put in a May 12, 2021 affidavit of Curtis Ripley. He put in a document from the probate. And what is going on in Arizona, if we look at it, attached as Exhibit A to that affidavit is in the matter of the estate of Michael T. Connerin, Jr., which, as we've told you, the probate action is pending in Arizona. So we look at the document he attached. It doesn't name Vesper as a party. There are no defendants. There was no claims made. Vesper's not a party. Knipe's not a party. Crane's not a party. Tax Maximizer's not a party. But we've got an amended petition for delivery of estate assets and information. That's the only thing in the record. And here's what the relief that's requested on page 5. What does the estate want Vesper and others to do? It says instruct Knipe, Tax Maximizers, Heather Hendricks, Hendricks Law Firm, Vesper, Perfect Dwellings, and Crane to deliver to the personal representative any and all documentation which contains evidence of or tends to disclose the right, interest, or claim of decedent to any property as well as any estate property in their possession. So give me your, they're basically saying, I'm trying to administer this estate. I think it appears you've got documentation. You might have some other estate property, who knows, documents, cells, cell phone records, whatever. because of the relationship they evidently had with Mr. Connor, and give that to me so I can try to get to the bottom of this. So that is all that's gone on in Arizona. There's certainly, and when we look at that pleading as a whole, there's certainly no claim to quiet title of the property, no claim of fraud, no claim to pierce the corporate veil. So this notion that, well, this is better off in Arizona is just because they've already sued there. Why would we sue in two places? We haven't, and it isn't, because I'll tell you what would happen if this case wasn't here, where it rightfully is, in light of Vesper's ownership of the property and the nature of Vesper and the veil piercing claims. If there's no claim in Minnesota, we've got a Liz Pendens filed here. If there's no claim in Minnesota, I'm sure the next request will be get rid of the Liz Pendens and allow me to sue the which would allow them perhaps to sue to sell the property. I also
So you think that the estate, because you said it could only be brought here. So you were saying that the estate could not bring an action in Arizona to seek property that rightfully, in your view, belongs to the estate on the basis that there was a fraudulent conveyance of that property? Well,
my understanding is you could sue the individuals, but I don't believe there's anything that the Arizona court could do to affect or to change the title to the Minnesota real estate. I mean, if the claim was litigated in Arizona, I think there would also have to be ultimately a Minnesota action to quiet the title to the property. That's what I mean in that regard. So I think it's the most appropriate forum. And I also want to just briefly address with regard to jurisdiction, the notion that these subsequent actions don't bear on jurisdiction, as in the efforts to get the money from the Crystal Sugar stock and the property. And I think they very much do, because what we effectively have here is an ongoing fraud. I fraudulently took title of the property, and now I'm continuing my actions with new claims if they were to get the money arising after the fact to get the money from the property. So I think there's a clear jurisdiction. Just briefly with regard to the escrow, no parties alleged a harm. And a requirement, as the district court did, to escrow the funds will only protect Minnesotans and Minnesota use of this property. No parties alleged a harm. It keeps things safe and prevents harm to other parties.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Ripley, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I heard Mr. Hasbrook correctly, he said that this would be the only, Minnesota would be the only jurisdiction where we could litigate these claims. There was a question a little later in his argument about whether there would ultimately have to be a quiet title. I simply don't think that's correct. If there are two out-of-state parties who negotiated a sale entirely out of state, and they wanted to sue each other in their home state for determination of that transaction, I don't think there's any law that said they would have to go to Minnesota. And I guess the hypothetical that I would use is if two California parties, I'll put it in California, not Arizona, just to eliminate confusion here. If two California parties negotiated for the sale from one California party to the other of some land that happened to be situated in Minnesota, and those two parties later had a dispute as to the validity of that transaction or whether the property was actually transferred, I think those two Californians would be surprised to learn that they can't go to court in California. They must go to court in Minnesota to determine the title to that land. It happens all the time where out-of-state courts determine disputes between residents of their states, even if the underlying dispute happens to concern assets that are out of state. There was also a brief discussion about NREM jurisdiction, and I'm not really sure where that ended up. NREM jurisdiction was not something that was argued to the district court. I don't know that respondent is trying to change theories now. It doesn't sound like that, but to the extent they are, this is a question of personal jurisdiction. And as the court pointed out, NREM jurisdiction is not a way to bypass the minimum contacts analysis that is required for personal jurisdiction. Mr. Hasbrouck also talked a little bit about this underlying transaction, which he describes as wrongful and fraudulent. And those allegations kind of ring throughout the case as well. As we point out in our brief, there are two sides to that story. We think this transaction made a lot of economic sense for Mr. Connerin. We don't believe the assets were worth $10 million. We use tax-assessed values for those, and considering the debt that was on both of these assets, the purchase price of $7.5 million was pretty close to being right on. And there's a dispute in this case about who was to get the income. Mr. Connerin, during his lifetime, actually did receive the income from these assets. None of these are issues that this court has to decide today. The validity of the underlying transaction is something that is going to be litigated. We think the appropriate place is to litigate that is in Arizona. But there are two sides to that story, and mere allegations are of the severity of the underlying transaction are not enough to get around an earnest minimum contacts due process analysis for each defendant. There's also been a lot of discussion about this Arizona probate, and I think the fact is that the estate is advancing this same theory against these same defendants in Arizona. It's styled and it's titled a little bit differently in Arizona because it's a probate action, but they're seeking to reverse and unwind this transaction through the Arizona probate.
And do we see that, counsel? Is your record support that same Ripley affidavit? Is that where we should be looking? Is there something else?
That's correct. I believe that is in there as well, but the document that, and again, this was a relatively early stage in the district court process as well, but I believe my affidavit contains one of their pleadings from the underlying Arizona probate case, in which they make really the same arguments as here, that this transaction was produced by fraud, that Mr.
I'm sorry, I might have misunderstood. Let me be more specific. You said you think it's there as well in the attachment to the Ripley, your affidavit. What does as well mean? In other words, are you asserting that, are you relying on the same record evidence as we heard described, or is there more about what's happening in Arizona? Or is there one document we can look at, one attachment to your affidavit?
It's just
a matter of interpretation.
Correct. And I don't even think it's a matter of interpretation. Okay. There is that one document in our case, which I think is basically the equivalent of their complaint in the Arizona probate. Again, because it's Arizona and not Minnesota, and because it's a probate action, not your standard lawsuit, things are styled a little bit differently. But I think if one reads that document, it's the very same theories and the very same ultimate relief, which is to unwind this transaction. And so this plaintiff is going to get its day in court, regardless of this court's ruling on minimum contacts.
Thank you, Mr. Ripley. Thank you, Mr. Hasbrouck. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision in 90 days. That being our last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.